Welcome to All Rise, the Gonzaga Law Podcast. I'm Ryan McNeese. I've had the opportunity over the last decade and a half to be the founder of McNeese Wheeler Law Office, as well as Intermountain Leasing, and the founder of 57 Media. We're thrilled to bring you the very first episode of All Rise. Today's guest is none other than Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Ferguson is the 18th Attorney General for the state of Washington. As the state's chief legal officer, Ferguson protects Washingtonians from what he calls powerful interests that don't play by the rules. He is a fourth-generation Washingtonian and a friend to Gonzaga Law who occasionally stops by to guest lecture and give advice to students. In fact, you may have recently seen him argue on our behalf on late-night television when he swore on a Bible to prove our existence to Jimmy Kimmel. Our own professor, Ann Murphy, sat down with Ferguson to ask about his career, his life, and his least favorite class in law school. For more information about this podcast and our guests, please visit gonzaga.edu/law/podcast.
I'm here with Attorney General Bob Ferguson. My name's Ann Murphy, and we're so grateful for you to come do this for us. It's our first one, so it's very special. So I've read a lot of your background, and I've heard you speak before, and so I have a few questions.
Okay, I'm ready.
So I wondered, you do like to hike a lot, and you climb mountains. So what would be your next choice if you could climb anywhere?
Any mountain at all?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good first question. So my son Jack is here in the room, of course, and he's into climbing as well and hiking, which is great. I'm enjoying that with him. But for me to do a peak, I think the next one I would probably pick is it's Granite Peak. It's in Montana. It's the highest peak in Montana. I have a goal of getting to the highest point in all 50 states. I've got several left to go. That's one of them. I haven't done any for a while. I've been a little busy on the work side and family side. But that's a peak. It's supposed to be a beautiful peak. It's a multi-day hike and climb. And so that one would be high on my list.
That would be great. What do you do for states that don't have any peaks at all, like Illinois?
You're right that some don't require ice axe or supplemental oxygen. So those, there is always some point that is the highest, whatever that is.
True.
And so part of it is just fun to go explore the whole country.
Oh, yes.
And some are real legitimate peaks, obviously, around the country.
Absolutely.
So it's more of a fun thing to do that kind of force you to get out to certain places around the country you might not otherwise get to.
That's really a great, great idea. So if you, I also know you're a chess master. Mm-hmm. If you had to put our country on a board, on a chessboard right now, where would we be?
Well, I guess what I would say is that in chess, kind of oversimplifying a little bit, you have positions that are often what they call very positional, quiet positions. Doesn't mean stuff isn't going on, but it's quiet, right? And positional, things are moving more slowly. Others are extremely dynamic. Someone has sacrificed a piece, you're under attack, it's very dynamic. I would certainly put it in the latter category, where a lot is going on. And in those situations, in a positional situation, the consequence of one relatively poor move is not so great. In contrast, if you're in a very dynamic position, or it's very tactical, one poor move and the game can be over.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's my feeling that there's a lot at stake right now in our country. Certain norms are being broken, constitutional limitations are being challenged, and so I would put it in that category. But I think there's a, just like in a chess game, you can navigate through complicated positions. I feel confident our country will do the same as well.
Good, thanks. Okay, so who would you say is your first mentor that you had?
My first mentor, I mean, it was, you're actually probably in the world of chess potentially, right? A mentor in chess, I had an early chess coach who was very influential on me. He was a man from Britain and was a very good chess player and took me under his wing when I was a little boy starting out in chess. And he was someone who instilled many things, but one was in chess you can win, you can lose, or it can be a draw. The players can agree to a draw without the game going all the way to its conclusion. And he was someone who really instilled, you always play for the win. Always, always, always. You don't take draws. Even that means you risk losing, that's okay. You play to win. And that was, at a young age, that was very formative for me. And in law, individual named Fred Towson was a partner whose law office was right next to mine. And in my first job in a law firm, he was very influential. And then I'd say the two judges who I clerked for, Judge Nielsen right here in Spokane, and Judge Bright, who's passed away of the Eighth Circuit. I mean, anytime you clerk for a judge, you're rubbing shoulders with them every day. And those two men were hugely influential on me and the court system and the rule of law and everything that goes along with it.
is wonderful. What was your least favorite class in law school?
Least favorite class? Yeah, that's well. First, I did actually like law school quite a bit. I'll confess to that. I really enjoyed it. You know, I have to say, I took tax, and I can't say it knocked me out. But that said, I'm not someone who really thinks about money. It's just not my. I sort of forced myself to take it, thinking it'd be sort of good for me.
Yes.
So maybe I put that one, but that's not a. That wasn't on the professor. That was really on me. My heart just wasn't in it, so that was probably reflected in my grade as well. Yeah.
So I teach tax.
Oh, is that right there?
So that's why I'm laughing. So
I did, as you can see, I did not read my briefing paper before this interview.
Oh my goodness.
So walked in there.
You know, I can't lose because I go into the class and I figure they think they're going to hate it. So if they kind of sort of hate
right.
it,
then
it's all relative.
So that's pretty funny.
Yes.
Yeah.
How about your favorite class in law school?
Yeah, there were a couple. We were actually chatting before my property class, which was as a child was your least favorite.
Yes.
Happened to be really one of my favorites in large part because of the professor I had. Her name is Vicky Breen, and Vicky Breen. She was a very very wonderful professor at New York University. I would say I really. I thought I might be interested in it, and I was, all the constitutional law type of courses. And, you know, perhaps not surprising given the work that I'm doing, but I thought I'd like them, but I really enjoyed them. And grappling with the constitutional issues of the day, past, present, and future. And so I would say that was a whole course of study. I took some additional constitutional classes. And then one other class, actually, now I think about it, it's been a while since I graduated, but there was a class taught by Tony Amsterdam, a professor who argued many of the death penalty cases before the Supreme Court in the 1970s in opposition to the death penalty. Okay. And he taught a course with another professor that was all about, it was actually using texts that were not necessarily related to the law. It was all about telling a story, like how you tell a story in your briefs, how you tell a story before a judge or a court, and using other types of texts that dealt with the law, but it could be a novel, it could be a poem, it could be any number of things, but how did they talk about the law as a narrative device and to speak about a defendant or a plaintiff or a legal matter in other contexts? How do you apply that to briefing? And the power of telling a story, it's something I talk to my team about all the time. In all of our cases, you're telling a story. Don't lose sight of that. Yes, you got to be good on the law, be on top of the law, but you need to have a narrative arc to what you're talking about as well.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. So what would you say is the accomplishment of which you're most proud?
Oh, man. I guess I don't really think in those terms, honestly. Life's pretty busy, you know, so I don't really, you know, I'd say my wife and I were proud of our kids. You know, Jack and Kay, we have 10-year-old twins, and so we're proud of them. And so being a dad is my most important job right now, I'd say for sure. In the legal standpoint, you know, it's hard to say, but I guess, you know, the first travel ban case where Washington was the first state to challenge the president, when we filed alone.
Yeah.
We won that case, and being in the courtroom that, for the trial court judge, we won a case that the legal experts of the country thought we were going to lose.
Yes.
And just the stakes of that case, you know, that was pretty big, obviously. And so I think as a lawyer, you know, that would certainly be right up there, just given the, you know, there was a lot of focus on that case and on that courtroom at that time, and to have won, the legal team did such a great job, that was rewarding for a lot of reasons. Winning, of course, is great, but what it meant, I think, for the people who were impacted by the Muslim travel ban, what it meant for the rule of law in our country, I think was really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you decide if you'll argue a case or you'll have an assistant argue the case?
Yeah, I've actually only argued one case in my time as Attorney General. It was a state Supreme Court case around whether a flower shop could refuse to sell flowers to a gay customer. Flowers they would sell to a heterosexual couple, but not for a gay couple, and I argued that one personally. If we ever have a U.S. Supreme Court case, I would be likely to take that on. The challenge for me is just that the job's busy. You know, you're basically a managing partner of a law firm of more than 1,000 employees, and it's just it's hard to carve out the time necessary to do the job required to argue a case of any magnitude well, and. So I don't rule out doing it in the future. I enjoyed doing it, the one case I did. But just as the, you know, it's a lot different time than when Slate Gordon was Attorney General. And he argued, I think, a dozen cases for the U.S. Supreme Court. Like, literally, himself argued a dozen. The law firm was much smaller then. It was a very different operation than it is now. And so Do I wish I had more time for that? Sometimes, yes. But it'd have to be really the right case where I felt I really could do just as good a job as anyone else in my office, and one that I feel really strongly about.
It's really generous of you to give those opportunities to people.
It's important. I mean, it's all the lawyers who work in my office, they can make a lot more money working at a private law firm. But there are advantages to working in the AG's office. You get in court earlier, you get more responsibility earlier. That is the nature of it, and I'm a believer in that. My solicitor general, who argued the travel ban case, when I hired him as solicitor general, I think he was 31 when I hired him, youngest solicitor general in the country. He'd never argued a case for the U.S. Supreme Court or even the state Supreme Court. But I really felt he was a uniquely gifted individual, which he most certainly is, and he's demonstrated that. But I believe in giving a lot of responsibility to people. If they demonstrate they're hard workers, they're talented, you know, they'll get after it.
Yep.
If you demonstrate that, I don't really – you don't have to check certain boxes on your resume for me to say, hey, go off and do that.
Right.
And I think that's worked well for us as an office. And I just always felt, for example, when I was a lawyer, I could handle more responsibility than I was sometimes given. And so I just felt, hey, pass that on to, you know – the folks in my office.
I agree. I agree. How about, would you rather have somebody who's really, really smart or somebody who works hard?
Oh, I'd have to say someone who works hard. I mean, you have to have a certain level of intellect, obviously, right? Let's just assume there's a certain, but, you know, sometimes I'm asked, hey, Bob, how did you become Attorney General? How did you do those things? And, you know, I often say it's not because I'm the smartest lawyer in my office. I'm not. You know, I'm not the smartest lawyer in my office. I'm not the smartest lawyer in the state. But, you know, I make it a point not to be outworked by anybody, whether it's a political campaign or a case I'm working on or a chess game I'm playing. I mean, that's just my philosophy. And I do believe that hard work, really hard work, can overcome a lot, right? If you don't have a certain expertise in an area, if you're willing to put the time in to develop that expertise, you can develop it. And so, yes, you have to come out with a certain level of competence to any endeavor. But hard work, I think, is candidly underappreciated sometimes. And I can't tell you how important that is to me. And I just feel for myself, that's been the key. The key is just sheer determination will get you a long, long ways.
It definitely does. Who's someone you admire?
Well, there's a lot of folks I admire. I mean, sort of historically speaking, if I was going to pick someone, well, we're here at Gonzaga, so this is maybe an appropriate person to talk about as well. Someone who I've often admired is Archbishop Romero, Archbishop of in El Salvador, of course, was assassinated for his work on behalf of the poor in that country. And he's really a fascinating guy. I find him to be a fascinating guy. I mean, he was someone who, you know, as a bishop, was not particularly interested or focused on the inequities in his country. And when he became Archbishop, he was appointed that position because the church and the military and the government thought he would not be someone who would stir things up. You'll go along, just like everybody else has. And he became exposed to when a Jesuit friend of his was killed, priest was killed. He became very much aware of the inequities in his country and really, you know, spoke powerfully on behalf of the poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized in his country, at great personal risk to himself, and sort of brought the bully pulpit of his office, which is obviously a huge one in Central America and his country specifically. And, you know, he paid for that with his life, as it turned out, while saying Mass. And so I've always found him to be someone really inspirational because it wasn't like he always had a certain focus there. Like, he grew into it, right? He came into a position of great responsibility and then was open-minded enough to realize, wait a second, things are not what I always thought. There are inequities. I'm now in a certain position where I have a responsibility. He could have taken the easier path and avoided that. But instead, he, you know, owned up to his own failures, I think he would say openly, about not recognizing those inequities and really being a voice that gave a lot of hope to so many people in his country. So I've always found him to be a really inspirational person on many levels.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I mean, he's now been canonized, of course, and as a saint. And but no, he's someone who I really think is his writing is excellent. And I encourage folks to learn more about him.
I will. That sounds awesome. So, who's your all-time favorite Supreme Court justice?
Favorite Supreme Court justice? That might be a little harder for me to pick a. I mean, I will say this. I'm not sure necessarily favorite from necessarily all legal opinions, et cetera, but I will say I'm partial to Justice William O. Douglas being from Washington State. Mm-hmm. I know a lot about him because he's from Washington State. In fact, this summer, my son Jack and a group of folks on an anniversary of he did a protest hike along the Washington coast to protect the Washington coast from development. There's going to be a highway built along mm-hmm. it. A group of folks, including my kids and environmental activists and others, recreated that hike to protest the Trump administration's desire to drill for oil off the Pacific coast, and we wanted to protest that. And so he was someone who was, I'm not sure how to be looked on today, he was such an activist in a way that might be frowned upon today, really, as a justice. But being a Washingtonian, mm-hmm. Obviously a brilliant guy, obviously, and someone I find a really fascinating person. I've read a lot about him and his books. Would I hold him up as necessarily my number one justice from certain legal perspectives? Perhaps not, but certainly he's someone who, on many levels, I admire. And being a Washingtonian, I'm always partial to that.
That's great. Yeah. How about over time, who would you most admire who has been in politics?
And someone who's alive today, or could be anyone, or what's
anyone.
It's always hard to sort of pick any one person. There's a lot of folks who I admire. I mean, in general, I tend to appreciate folks who are very clear about what their views are. They don't shy away from that, even if it means you are going to make some people unhappy. If you're going to say things to people that they don't want to hear. I mean, I think that's what politics really should be. Sort of depends how you define politics. I mean, sort of outside elected office, obviously Martin Luther King Jr. was someone who embodied that in many, many ways. From the 1960s, I actually went to a movie it's called Return to Mount Candy. It's a movie about Jim Whittaker, mountain climber from Washington State, and Bobby Candy, who climbed a peak in Canada named after John Candy.
I remember that.
After John Candy was assassinated, the Canadian government named this peak after John Candy, and the two of them and others went to climb it. And so I've always been in my office. I have a framed signed picture of Bobby Candy in my office, for example, and one of his campaign posters in my office. So he's someone I've always admired quite a bit as well. But in general, I do admire politicians, whatever their sort of political orientation is, but if they really stand up for something, and just despite the conflict that can sometimes can arise from that. Politicians I like the least are those who are just so dang cautious. You know, they don't want to rock the boat. I'm like, hey, find another line of work. You know, I mean, politics is a contact sport, and I think people expect you to say what you think and let the chips fall where they may. And I love the work that I do, but hey, if the voters decide they want someone else, that's okay, Mm-hmm. I'll have more time for Jack and Katie and can climb more mountains and find something else to do. And I would miss the work, but I would feel like, hey, I did what I thought was the right thing to do, and just let the chips fall where they may. I think that's very important in politics.
Great. And so with your children, mm-hmm. so I know Jack likes to climb
with
you.
Yes, he does.
Does your daughter like to climb with you?
Yeah, she does. And I'd say she may be somewhat less enthusiastic. She'll ask a bit more how much further, right? So Jack, to his credit, I'm saying this about him while he's here, he never asked that. So he's a true climber in that sense. But they both did the hike on the coast, which was... the hike on the coast for a few days, it is rocky, it is difficult, you're going over headlands, you got a pack on your back. I mean, it's not an easy hike for an adult. Yeah. They both did it and did it well. So my wife and I were big into camping. Most of our vacations are going to national parks, we're hiking, we're climbing, we're camping. That's kind of our whole world when we've got free time. And for me, the outdoors, that's one reason I love, Washington State so much. And I find that to be a complete break. Cell coverage is spotty or non-existent. That's a positive for me. And you're with your kids constantly, you're in the tent, you're sharing. You know what I mean? They're not on devices. Nobody is. You're just hanging out together, and I love that. Plus, I just love being in the natural world.
It's real.
Yeah,
it's real.
Yeah.
In what way are you too hard on yourself?
I don't know if I'm too hard on myself, really. I guess I'm not sure I've ever been asked that. I'm a pretty fairly driven person, So I set very high expectations for myself. Anyone who knows me would say that for sure. But I don't view that as being too hard. I just think that's just life, and I've got expectations and things I want to do, and I plan on doing them. And so, I think like anyone who has a full-time job and that is a busy job and children, sometimes,
the balance,
right? You can't have it all, right? There are you're sacrificing something.
Yes.
So for me, that can be a real challenge. And so I was very fortunate as a kid. I'm one of seven kids. six boys, one long-suffering sister, my family of seven, and then our family. We were very lucky that, you know, my mom's still alive, my father's passed away, both parents very involved with their kids. But, you know, my father, especially for a man of his generation, mm-hmm. was especially involved with his kids. You know, he was someone who, he came home, he was shooting hoops in the driveway, he was going to every soccer game, every basketball game. And that's, you know, my work life is, you know, he worked at Boeing, he could be home at 5:20 every night. My job doesn't quite work that way. Right. But I try to, you know, make sure that I'm, you know, a good father and spend the time with them. Mm-hmm. And that's important to me. There's a sacrifice for that. I love my work, but I guess I'm not sure if I'm too hard on myself, but I spend a lot of time thinking about that and trying to navigate that. And that's maybe my biggest challenge that I have.
Yeah. So I was really intrigued when I saw you are a fourth generation Washingtonian, because that's just amazing.
Yeah.
So that's your great, great, great grandfather and mother.
Correct. Yeah.
So do you know anything about them?
A little bit, yeah. So they came out to, my great, great, great grandfather came out from, I think he was in Eastern Canada, came out and homesteaded up in Skagit County along the Skagit River near what's now Marble Mount, a small town up there. Mm-hmm. And as we like to say, we're not sure what he was running from, but he ran a long ways to get away from whatever was following him. So he settled. It was pre-statehood, we believe. And then his wife came later. He kind of sent for her once he got things set up.
Yep.
And so the family's been here a long time, and I'm proud of that. I mean, there aren't a lot of families that go back to statehood or pre-statehood as mine does, and. You know, it's why I often think if you gave me a choice of, so I identify very strongly with Washington State. Yep. If you gave me a choice where I could live anywhere in the world, but I could never come to Washington State, where I could only live in Washington and I could never leave, I would choose to stay in Washington and never leave. I mean, it'd be easy. You know, it wouldn't even be a question for me. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of my siblings feel the same way.
Oh, great. So one last question, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
If you could teach everyone in the world one thing, what would it be?
That's a good question. I think if I could teach one thing, this would certainly be any list of top things, but I would say, in fact, I'll be speaking about it tonight. I'm speaking tonight at Gonzaga to the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, an organization that I was involved in as a volunteer, and I'll probably talk about this there, is that the importance of listening that I find in my job as a lawyer. I think it's important.
Yep.
I think as a parent it's important, as a friend it's important, whatever endeavor, but I think listening is undervalued, underappreciated. And I think it's really important. And I think anyone on my team would tell you, hey, when I'm in a meeting with my team, we're talking about a potential case, I'm not doing most of the talking, right? My job is my team's giving me advice. They're going through the options. I'm asking questions. My job is to ask questions,
yep.
right? And then filter it all and make a decision. But, you know, I remember once when I was, after I finished, I was in law school, rather, and I went to, during my summer of law school, my first summer, I got a grant to do public interest work, and I went to Guadalupe, Arizona. It's a Yaqui Indian community, and there's a Jesuit priest there who is a lawyer and helped folks in that community with a variety of legal issues. So I went there to help, basically. But I was only first-year law student. I didn't know anything about the law. And I remember the first day when I went to see him, he said, hey, here's your first assignment. There's a lady down the street, I'll call her Mrs. Sanchez. She had an issue. I think she had a life insurance policy. Someone in her family passed away and the company wouldn't pay it out.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to go down there and help her get it back. And I remember saying, I don't know anything about this. I'm a first year law student. You're coming, right? No, he's not coming, right? He said, you'll just go down there. I literally was like, and I remember, I'll never forget what he said. He said, Bob, just go down there, listen to her, listen carefully, and then you'll figure out what to do. And, you know, he was right. I mean, but that approach of just listening carefully, right, is so important. And, you know, getting that money back for her was, you know, it was a very formative experience for me. You know, that the power of using the law in a way to help people.
Yes.
Access to justice, you know, which is a huge challenge of folks like Mrs. Sanchez not always having the ability to have someone in court advocating for them mm-hmm. and their rights. And so that was a lesson I learned early, thankfully, in my law career. And it's one that I think is really important.
And I agree. I think it's very undervalued.
It is. And, you know, a family of seven, there are many advantages of being part of a family of seven, but one is it requires that, really. I mean, if you try to start talking too much around the dinner table, your older brother is going to shut you down
exactly.
in a hurry, right? And
yes.
so, but it is, I think it's, it is something that I think I learned as a kid and as a lawyer, and I think it's served me well.
Thank you. Well, I truly can't thank you enough. You've been really generous with Gonzaga. And so we're going to pay you back by winning. the game tomorrow.
I thought I got my word was a free attendance one of your tax classes. That's what I thought it was going to be. But we'll make that next time.
Absolutely.
All right, it's a deal. Yeah. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.